I'm John Kroll. Indianapolis soon will host the National Preservation Conference. Today on No Limits, we'll talk about what this means for the city. And more generally, we'll talk about the challenges of connecting the past, present, and future through the preservation of local landmarks. My guests will be Marsh Davis and Suzanne Stanis of Indiana Landmarks, and Paul Smith, the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We look forward to talking with you. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today, we're marking the fact that Indianapolis is going to be hosting the National Historic Preservation Conference. My guests are Marsh Davis with Indiana Landmarks. Marsh, welcome back to the program.
John, thank you. It's
good to be here. You're a veteran now. Yeah, is this number two or the third time?
Three.
So,
always
yeah,
good to be here.
Like that Saturday Night Live skit. We'll have you can phone this one in and we'll just give you the velour jacket or whatever. Suzanne Stanis, also from Indiana Landmarks. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Paul Smith, who is the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis. Paul.
I'm a newbie.
You are a newbie.
Yes, sir.
Well, if you would like to join the conversation today, please do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Marsh, could you talk a little bit about the significance of bringing this conference here, what it's going to mean to the city?
Yeah, sure.
Indiana, to some degree.
Right. We are going to spread beyond Indianapolis, but we have tried twice before to bring this conference to Indianapolis. It has about a 60-year history, and it's traveled really to all the major cities in the United States. And back in 2009, we bid on this conference, and we're pleased for the third time trying to get it here. It means a lot to us in the world of historic preservation because this is, as we call it, this is the grand summit or our Super Bowl in our world of historic preservation. And it brings people to the city who have a keen eye toward the quality of life, toward the uniqueness of the architecture, toward the local character. And it's a special group. I know Indianapolis hosts hundreds and thousands of conferences and conventions, but there's some groups really have a special focus when they come here. And this is one of those groups. It's really going to take a good look at how we live here in Indianapolis, how our design, our urban design, our architecture builds a quality of life.
Suzanne, how many people will be coming as this? What's the scope of the conference?
We think we'll have about 1,500 people here for it, and they'll be going on field sessions, which are mobile workshops around the city and the state. They'll be going to education sessions on a variety of topics related to economic development, heritage tourism, social media, just a variety of ways that they can build on their preservation efforts.
What parts of the city or the state are you going to show these folks?
Well, we're getting them all over the place, and that's been one of the fun things about working on this conference is it's made us go back and look at all the accomplishments and all the things that we've done through historic preservation. But just a few of the field sessions of the Indianapolis area, be looking at dealing with the abandoned housing issue on Fountain Square and some creative ways that they've dealt with that. We'll be looking at some successful commercial historic district revitalizations like Irvington and, again, Fountain Square and Massachusetts Avenue. Marsh is leading a tour on the automotive heritage. A lot of people have no idea beyond the Speedway just what a rich automotive heritage we have. So we're taking them everywhere.
Marsh, where are you going to take them for the automotive tour?
Well, basically two places, two stops. We're heading first to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, but it's kind of inescapable, I think. Yeah.
But there are so many spots along the way that buildings that were built for the auto industry. Showrooms, factories have been repurposed, happily. We've lost a lot of them, but there are still some that remain that are not known for what they were originally built for. And then at the Speedway, we'll have a special Q&A with Donald Davidson, which is always fascinating, and the trip around the track for the people who've not been there before. And then we're heading back into town to the Stutz building to be greeted by Turner Woodard and talk about the revitalization of that wonderful resource and the history of the automotive industry here. Local automotive historian George Maley, who knows more about this than anybody I've ever met, will be leading us on the bus tour.
Paul, what is your role in all of these festivities?
Well, in my capacity as the real estate manager for the city, I hold the keys to the old City Hall. And Marsh can talk about the charrette that's going to be held at Old City Hall next Tuesday. So from an official capacity, it's just being able to have the keys to get everybody in. My other role is that I'm the chair of the Candlelight Tour, which will be held a week from tonight in the Old North Side Historic District. And so I've got two hats to wear. For this particular program today.
What is the Candlelight Tour?
Candlelight Tour is eight very gracious homeowners have offered to have their homes open for a three-hour period of time between 7 and 10 next Thursday night to let the folks from the National Trust as well as some general public folk to come in and take a look at these wonderful homes that have been restored over the past, well, these houses were built in the 1800s and probably over the last 10, 20, 30 years have undergone all kinds of restoration. We're very proud of what we've done in the Old North Side, and we're anxious to get these national folks in to take a look at what we've done. A
couple of questions. How did you choose the Old North Side as the place that you were going to do the tour?
Well, Indiana Landmarks is located in the Old North Side. Mm-hmm. That helps. Mm-hmm. That helps a great deal. They moved into that wonderful old church at 12th and Central. And I think the Old North Side is probably next to Lockerbie Square, probably is the oldest historic district in the city of Indianapolis. And we also are one of the largest ones, so we have lots of homes to choose from. So I think that's my general sense of how it was chosen, but I'm certain that Marsh and Suzanne might be able to add to that.
Well, and I'll throw this one open to the group. How did you select the eight homes? Too. That I would think, because there has been an awful lot of restoration, and the way you're looking at me suggests that I just wandered into something.
No. Well, no, this probably should come as no surprise to you, but not everyone in the world wants to have, you know,
1,500 people walking through their house.
Don't use that number. You'll scare a lot of people off. We think it's less than half of that, but no,
so,
you know, it's
so only 750.
Right, exactly, and that's daunting. That's daunting for a number of people, and that's why I used the word gracious when I opened up and talked about these eight homeowners. I mean, it really takes a lot. But one of the things that has helped a lot is the prestige of this National Trust. These folks who have offered to open up their homes know that the best of the best when it comes to people who appreciate preservation, these are the folks who will be going through their homes, and it's almost like a badge of honor, if you will. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think one of the things we'd like to do for our homeowners is to give them some sort of letter from the National Trust after it's all over thanking them for that, and I suspect that perhaps some of them might like to frame that and have it inside their home. It's a very prestigious event. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. No, we're talking about the fact that the National Historic Preservation Conference is going to occur here in Indianapolis just next week, right? What are the dates, Marsh?
Well, it officially opens on Wednesday, but there's some preliminary activities starting as early as Monday afternoon.
So basically when people start flying in,
right,
for the most
Monday
part.
Afternoon, 1 o'clock, it kicks off for a lot of us and wraps up in Columbus, which is an important part of this conference, I should mention, Saturday afternoon, and then it's done. So that's November 2nd.
So literally, it's going to go on for about 5 days.
Yes.
Then you're going to have people here. Now, who all will be coming to this, Suzanne? Is there any way for the general public to engage, or is it more a sort of specialist driven conference?
Certainly, the general public can come, and there are sessions geared from beginners to professionals. There will be a lot of preservation professionals in statewide organizations like our own, in government agencies. There'll be a lot of students, but it really is open to anyone.
And if people did want to go, how would they go about finding out what is offered and perhaps reserving a spot?
Well, if they want to register in advance, they better take advantage of that today, because the advance
registration
closes today. But you can register at the door and pay by a daily rate. But they can go to indianalandmarks.org, and on our homepage, we've got information about the conference. Or you can go to the National Trust website, which is preservationnation.org.
Give those two URLs again.
Certainly.
People, much as I wish they would sit by the radio with pencil in hand when we speak, they don't do that.
Certainly. So indianalandmarks.org or preservationnation.org.
And if they want to attend the sessions, you mentioned that they can pay at the door. What is the cost?
The daily fee is $275 on Wednesday and $250 for a daily pass on Thursday. The at-the-door ticket price is $635. But the good news is that if that's a little out of your price range, or you're just not able to spend the time, the National Trust will be live streaming two of the events. One is the opening plenary with Henry Glassy. I'm sure Marsh can tell us a little bit more about that. And the other is a preservation award ceremony. And so they can go to, again, indianalandmarks.org website or the National Trust website and actually watch those events live.
And what will the plenary session be?
The plenary session is your typical business meeting of the National Trust, but there's also some fun. Mayor Ballard will be greeting us. Time for Three, the artist in residence at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, will be kicking it off with some fun entertainment. Mm-hmm. Stephanie Meeks, who is the president of the National Trust, will give an address, and some other people. But the keynote speaker is Henry Glassy, who is a folklore scholar who spent much of his career at Indiana University. He's been elsewhere, but he resides in Bloomington still and is one of the great masters of folklore and vernacular architecture and an absolutely stunning speaker. So we're thrilled to have Henry be part of this opening ceremony.
We are talking about the fact that Indianapolis is going to be hosting and it sounds like much of Central Indiana is going to be hosting the National Historic Preservation Conference next week. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've got all of these folks who have a shared passion coming to Indianapolis. What are they going to be talking about? What are the challenges facing historic preservationists right now? Why don't we start with what are the challenges here in Indiana and then talk about what the challenges are nationally? Marsh.
Well, this goes both local and nationally. One of the main themes of the conference is called paying for preservation. Now, that doesn't mean paying for our salaries at the Indiana Landmarks. It means how do we make basic real estate deals? How do we take on endangered properties and find ways to pay for them? And it's been a challenge throughout the years of historic preservation, but it seems to be particularly challenging these days with difficult credit, with rising costs here and there, new requirements, regulations. When we take on properties at Indiana Landmarks that are distressed, we often take on things that the market won't bear. That requires subsidy and sometimes an investment on our part that we don't recoup. That's usually the case, as Paul can attest, having chaired our real estate program for some time. So that's one of the big issues that we are taking very seriously, both locally and nationally.
What is the value, Paul, since you got mentioned, in terms of the city, to preserving some of these historic properties? I mean, the fact that we're holding on to an old city hall, when in fact we have one that has supplanted it now. What's the argument for doing that from the city's perspective?
I was asked that same question last week, and it would seem like an easy question to answer, and I suspect there are a number of different answers. The one that comes to mind immediately is that if one of these buildings is taken away from us, then it's gone forever. And if you go into the old city hall, for example, and look at the design features, the architecture, the colors, the space, just walk in there and it's just so full of wonderment. And if you compare and contrast that, for example, to the new City Hall, the 1960s version of City Hall, the city-county building. Mm-hmm. There's a remarkable difference in the way people were thinking back at the turn of the century when they built the old City Hall as opposed to what they were thinking in 1962 when the city-county building came on. And I think that we just need to honor and to respect and give homage to the wonderful buildings that were built back then. You know, can we save them all? Probably not. But I think there's great value to being able to have students, for example, coming in to take a look at this. If the City Hall weren't here, they wouldn't have something like that to look at. So I'm not sure it's easy to put a dollar value on it, but certainly there are so many intangibles that I think will reap rewards forever. So
we are talking about the fact that Indianapolis, Central Indiana, is going to be hosting the National Preservation Conference. My guests are Marsh Davis and Suzanne Stanis, Indiana Landmarks, Paul Smith, who's the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about historic preservation today on No Limits in honor of the fact that Indianapolis and actually much of Indiana are going to be hosting the National Historic Preservation Conference next week. Before we went to the break, we were talking about really what the value to a city is of preserving something like the old City Hall or holding on to these pieces of its past. Suzanne, your thoughts.
Well, what I love about preservation is that it connects with so many people for so many different reasons. I think Paul touched upon some of the emotional issues, and some of us really connect to the beauty of historic buildings or the fact that they have rich histories, and once they're gone, they're gone. But there's also economic value to it. There are plenty of developers that have renovated historic buildings, and they're not doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're making money on it. And we also see it revitalizing communities. We see things like Massachusetts Avenue, where buildings are being restored, and there's a sense of authenticity, and people want to be there, and they want to open their businesses. And then there's also, I work with a lot of children, and I explain to them that adaptively using buildings is no different than recycling bottles or cans. We're just taking something that's been discarded and we're giving it a new life. So whatever level you connect on, there's really kind of something for everybody in preservation.
Why is there resistance? I mean, and Marsh has been on the program before. We've had this conversation with, you know, the whole stereotype, they'll call you the Hysteric Preservation Society rather than the historic. Marsh is chuckling, but it's a pained chuckle, I can tell, because you've heard an awful lot. But why is there that kind of resistance to this idea of preserving landmarks from the past? Marsh, I'll start with you. I'm going to give everybody a crack at that one.
Well, there's an understandable confusion. There are so many agents. It's like an alphabet soup of agencies that have something to do with history or preservation. You have in our city the IHPC, the Indianapolis Historic Preservation Commission. You have the DHPA, the Division of Historic Preservation and Archaeology. And you have the National Register of Historic Places. You have National Historic Landmarks. You have local districts. And people begin to be overwhelmed by that. And there's still, it's still widely misunderstood what each of those things mean and what those agencies do. In general, there is a natural tendency among the rank and file to want to have as much freedom as possible, certainly understand, and that it means freedom to do exactly what I want with my property. Now, most places that we live don't allow that because we have responsibilities to our neighbors. Some of the historic areas that are locally designated have heightened layers of protection, which actually protect people's investment and are good things. They're good. Every measure of quality of life is increased when you have local historic designation, but not everybody likes it in theory because it suggests a layer of control. But I assure you that all the evidence points to the fact that when an area is designated and put under the aegis, in this case in Indianapolis, of the Indianapolis Historic Preservation Commission, that the quality of life, the property values are solidified, they're strengthened, and they improve.
At a personal level, I mean, that whole, the opposition, I mean, I would think you'd start to get a little frustrated with that, Suzanne.
We do sometimes, and I think there's also a notion sometimes that with certain types of buildings that old is bad, and we run into this particularly with schools. I think parents are concerned that their children attend schools that are the most modern and the most up-to-date, and that they have every opportunity possible. And what happens is a lot of times there are schools that need a lot of work and need a lot of rehabilitation, but historic schools can compete completely with their modern counterparts, and kids are able to learn as much and, again, be in that very authentic environment that says that this is a place of learning. And at one point, this was very important to us, and we built these beautiful buildings.
Paul, you sort of straddle both worlds in your capacity here. Where do you think the resistance to historic preservation comes from?
I think, as Marsh said, I think there's a sense about historic preservation. Without even thinking, I think there's this automatic knee-jerk reaction that says it's more expensive. And I think that's a fallacy, and it's been proven time and time again. But, you know, sometimes when there is a thought process out there that is either based in fact or not, it's sometimes hard to change people's minds. Just speaking personally, my wife and I live in a house that was built in 1882. And one of the things that we can't do that someone in a new house can do, for example, is we can't create the spaces that perhaps we'd like to create because we're restricted because of the size of the house and the walls that are there and so on and so forth. I think some people stay away from historic preservation because they want to design something that meets their needs and don't think they can do it in some of these old houses, which is why I really am excited about people getting a chance to come on the Candlelight Tour to get a chance to see what folks have done. Both, we have seven of those houses are old houses that have been restored, and one of them is a infill construction house, meaning that it's relatively new. And we have probably about a third of the houses in the Old North Side are infill construction.
We probably ought to explain what that is.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, in fact, I'd rather have either Suzanne or Marsh do the definition of infill because I'll screw it up.
All right, Marsh. I think that he was asking for that lifeline from you.
Yeah. Well, Paul knows more about this than anybody. He's a 36-year veteran of the Old North Side. Talk about somebody who's been committed to neighborhood revitalization. Infill is when you've had a row of houses on a block, and one or two or more of the houses go missing through one fact, one reason or another, and something gets built in their place. So you'll have six historic houses, and there'll be a seventh one, which is new construction. And in a historic,
but in keeping with the character of the neighborhood or the street, right?
Size, mass, and scale, which is one of the things that's required, so that if you're driving down the street, you don't get a sense that it's a new house. Yes, it's new, but it doesn't disrupt the streetscape.
Well, let me ask this then. You started this by saying you live in a house that was built in 1882.
Correct. Right.
And there are certain things you can't do, which would sound like a limitation. What are the satisfactions then, in terms of living in a house that's 130-plus years old?
Well, it's really cool space. I mean, my wife's an artist, for example, and this is just perfect for her because she can turn these rooms with the tall ceilings and just have her way in terms of decorating and doing things with these different kinds of spaces in old houses that perhaps she might not be able to do in a new house. It really lends itself well to an artist, for example. The restrictions, we understand them, but the passion we have for the old stuff and the way it was built, the quality of the design, the quality of the woodwork, for example, the fact that the walls are plaster and not drywall, there's just a million things that make these houses really special, and we're willing to accept the restrictions to be able to get the benefit of the wonderful things that these old houses bring us.
We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits in honor of the fact that next week, Indianapolis becomes ground zero for historic preservation with the arrival of the National Historic Preservation Conference here in Indianapolis. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's talk a little bit about what makes something worth preserving. I mean, I think we probably can agree, given its role in the city, that holding onto the old city hall is worth preserving. But suppose a fast food restaurant at the corner of 38th and Meridian might not be in some fashion. What are sort of the qualities or characteristics that go into making that decision? Marshall, start with you.
Again, many, many answers, not all of them right or wrong. We look, just one of them would be the quality of the design. Mm-hmm. Good architecture is one of the things, the quality of the materials. As Paul mentions, these materials are will not see them again. The kind mm-hmm. of quality woodwork that goes into to the buildings that tend to be older. Preservation is moving forward, though, pretty quickly. You mentioned fast food restaurants. One of the battles I remember early on as an intern was trying to save the old TP restaurant. Mm-hmm. And some of the folks thought, what are you trying to save that for? That's not mm-hmm. historic. Well, we thought it was. And today we wouldn't even question it. But back in the 1980s, it was still debatable whether or not the TP restaurant were. So our idea of what is historic and what's worth preserving is an ever-moving target. And it's much broader than just architecture and old buildings. It's about cultural history. It's about things that happened there. It can be a place where a significant event occurred. Many layers to this. It's obviously the easiest thing is to look at a beautiful structure and understand immediately why you'd want to save it. But there's sometimes you have to go beneath the surface to understand why a place is worthy of preservation.
Suzanne, Marsh has talked about the fact that this has evolved over time, that, you know, the idea of preserving what was a tremendous Indianapolis hangout, significant part of the culture here for generations, the teepee, was a source of some controversy, and now it would not be. What are the areas now in terms of historic preservation that the definition is being expanded?
Well, when you ask people what they think the age requirement is for something to be considered historic, they often just say 100 years old. But people don't realize that the National Register benchmark is typically 50 years old, and there are some things that are less than 50 years old that are listed. So we're now getting into the great wealth of buildings and properties that were built post-World War II. And an example of a neighborhood that I think people, if they drove through it, they'd have no idea from a visual standpoint that it's listed in the National Register of Historic Places, but it's Flanner House Homes, which is just north of Attucks High School. And while these are small post-war houses that are very modest, there's an extremely important story to be told, and this was one of the first self-help construction communities that was created in the United States, where the owners of the houses worked together to help build that. So much
sort
of it has to do with
an early Habitat for Humanity
exactly.
kind of approach.
So the social history is important too. So it's not just all about the design and what things look like.
And that area, how long has that area been part of the National Historic Register? How long has it been listed?
I think it's been listed, Marsh, within the last 5 years or so. It's not terribly long.
And is that part of a sort of a wave that's going across the country? I mean, I remember actually when I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and one of the early homes my parents lived in when they were very young newlyweds, social workers not making a whole lot of money, was a kind of duplex that had been built primarily for female construction workers. During World War II, which I would think now would be exactly the sort of thing. And they were built as duplexes so that the women could work in shifts and someone would be there keeping an eye on the kids. That sounds like the sort of thing. Are there other, you know, historical trends or housing, you know, solutions that you think are going to be worthy of preservation going forward that we don't even think about now? Marsh.
One of the hot areas right now in historic preservation is mid-century modern, and that's something that is new for some people. But it's not a new trend, but it's really hitting full stride right now. This fascination in the preservation world and elsewhere in the design of mid-century homes, ranch houses, the things that, you know, when a lot of us started working in preservation weren't even considering, but this is really being taken very seriously right now. And getting back for a moment to the National Preservation Conference, the last day of the conference will be focusing primarily on Columbus, Indiana, with its amazing collection of modern architecture, which is in recent years being labeled historic at the highest level. There are seven, I think, modern landmarks in Columbus that are not just National Register listed, but National Historic Landmarks. So it's it's an ever-broadening of the movement. Time moves along, which is one thing, but we're also finding ways to make historic preservation, rightly so, more relevant to people outside of the experience of living in grand old houses.
We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Juliet who says, will you highlight our trails and the Kessler plan? We are still completing all the connections now. Kessler was way ahead of his time. Thanks. Probably ought to tell people what the Kessler plan was, Suzanne.
Sure. It is listed in the National Register of Historic Places. George Kessler, and most people are familiar with Kessler Boulevard, designed not only that boulevard, but a series of boulevards and parkways that connect a lot of our parks together, Riverside and Fall Creek. And so we do have this amazing legacy, and it's great to see that in recent years the Parks Department has put a lot more focus on cleaning up these areas and highlighting them. There is a session that's dealing with the Mapleton-Fall Creek area, a field session, that will be looking at the Kessler Trail. But one of the things I might add that, you know, it's not possible to show everybody everything that we want to see. But what's been great about this conference is we have so many ideas for upcoming programming that we can do for the general public. And that's actually doing a bike tour of the Kessler plan is one of the things that we're hoping to do in the very near future.
We've also gotten from Facebook a question from a listener named Richard who says, what criteria are used in deciding which houses are going to be renovated? How about Paul? I'll throw that one your way.
Well, I mean, they all should be renovated, right? I mean, that's the answer to the no. I mean, you've got to have the bones. I mean, you've got to have a basic structure. Although, having said that, and having lived through watching the renovation of some of the homes in Lockerbie, for example, some of those started out as darn little. I mean, there was so much of it gone. It's amazing they were able to take what little was left and turn them into the fine homes that they are today. But I mean, it really takes a house that is in incredibly bad condition. I mean, literally getting ready to fall in on itself to probably not be considered for preservation and renovation, assuming, of course, that, you know, there's a want on the part of people to be able to do it. I mean, in our case, for example, in 1977, when we moved into the old North Side, this house seemed to beg for us to come and buy it and fix it up and try to bring it back to at least some sort of sense of what it was when it was first built. So I think you have to have the bones to be able to start with. Otherwise, I'm not sure that at the end of the day you've got a preservation project.
What makes something worthy of preservation? You know, an old house, Marsh or Suzanne, either one, would you say?
Well, we have to look at it, speaking from the Indiana Landmarks perspective,
yeah,
where when we take on a project, we have limited resources.
And how many projects do you do, say, during the course of a year?
Oh, scores. I mean, not necessarily full construction projects, but we have properties that we deal with all over the state, mm-hmm, where that we either acquire them or help local organizations acquire them. But we have to recognize that with the endless supply of buildings that we can only deal with a few. So we do have to have some parameters that we work within, and we do look for properties that have some architectural or historical significance. And another thing that's, I think, important is does a property have the potential for sparking community or neighborhood revitalization? Can this property be a catalyst for something beyond just saving an old building? That is really one of the key measures of our success, when we can do something that has a ripple effect, not just a one-off deal. But if we're going to spend our money and probably invest more than we'll ever recoup in a project, we want it to be a catalyst for a greater
other
good.
Growth.
Yes.
Other
growth. And that's been our history going back to Lockerbie Square, Old North Side.
Right.
We're doing it in Evansville. All over the state, we're doing this.
We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. The news hook for all of this is the fact that, as I've said a couple of times, Indianapolis is going to become ground zero for National Historic Preservation work next week when the National Historic Preservation Conference takes place here. That's what we're talking about. My guests are Marsh Davis and Suzanne Stanis of Indiana Landmarks, Paul Smith, who is the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about historic preservation in honor of the fact that the National Historic Preservation Conference will take place here in Indianapolis next week. My guests are Marsh Davis and Suzanne Stanis, both of Indiana Landmarks, and Paul Smith, who is the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis. There are opportunities for the public to engage with this conference and to take part in some of the discussions, the work that's going on there. Suzanne, could you tell them what they'll be able to do and where they might be able to find the information online or by calling you?
Sure. There's three events that the public can buy tickets to. So we want everybody to get involved with this, whether they can make it to the full conference or not. The first is on Wednesday evening, and it's the LGBT Built Party, and it's a costume party celebrating the contributions of the LGBT community to Indianapolis. And the second event is the Candlelight Home Tour that Paul was talking about, so tickets are available for that. And the third is our closing party, which is on Friday night at the Columbia Club, and it has a speakeasy theme. So if anybody's interested in attending these or finding out more information, they can go to IndianaLandmarks.org, and there is a link to buying tickets. And I might also add an added bonus on Halloween on Thursday night. There's also a silent movie, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, that's accompanied by an organ at Indiana Landmarks Center, and that's open to the public. So we hope people will come out for that.
And where you probably ought to tell them where the Indiana Landmarks Center is.
Because... Certainly. It's at 1201 Central Avenue. It's the former Central Avenue United Methodist Church.
Or the Old Central.
Or the Old Central, yes.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener, and I should say if you want to connect with us via Twitter or Facebook, you can do so at WFYI. This one comes from a listener named Matt, who said, I would love to see the city use the old city hall for government use. Maybe the mayor or some offices could move back into it. Paul, is that a possibility?
It's certainly been considered. There are a number of things that we're looking at, and that clearly is one of them. Excuse me. Part of the problem is that there is a significant infrastructure project that needs to be done in that building. The plumbing, the heating and air conditioning, the electrical,
sounds like basically everything but the walls.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's a significant, we're not exactly sure what the amount is, but we know it's in the millions, to replace all of those things. And frankly, we cannot justify the expenditure of taxpayer money at that level, because I'm not sure that at the rates the city is currently paying for office space downtown compared to what it would have to pay to be able to amortize the costs of this infrastructure investment makes any sense for us. If it was just a matter of moving over there, I think it would already be done. Now, having said that, the Department of Metropolitan Development is going to have a number of staff over there next year doing all kinds of collaborative things in hopes that bringing more people into that building, we might be able to find an end use together with a funding source that can come through to pay for those infrastructure costs I was talking about.
Is there, in that case, is there any effort underway to try to find, like, private contributions to restore the property or... foundation support?
Yeah, I think what our goal today is trying to reach out into the community to find out what ideas are out there for reuse for that building. I think if we can find something that makes sense for that building, it'll be a little easier, I think, at that point to go out and try to get funding for it. I think you have to have an end use in mind. You just can't go out to somebody and say, hey, would you mind throwing some money at the old city hall? And what is your sustainability plan?
Yeah,
what
do you
plan on
we'll
doing?
Use it well.
No, people aren't going to do that. So yeah. I think with and the tie-in that Marsh could talk about for a second on the charrette next week, we may be able to come up with some ideas that would be great for that building, a great reuse for that building.
Marsh.
Yeah, thanks. We have Indiana Landmarks has solicited for some time ideas for reuse. Now, everybody's got an idea, but coupling that with a team of people we're bringing in to the as part of this conference, So on Tuesday, the 29th of October, we're spending most of the, really a whole day at Old City Hall with 80 people participating in a big brainstorming session we call a charrette. Now this
what is a charrette?
A charrette is it's a term used in architecture school primarily as a quick and impromptu study that's delivered on charrette in a cart. That's how it gets its name. But it's a term used in schools of art and design to a quickly produced product. So I call it a sophisticated brainstorming session. Where we'll have...
But charrette sounds so much cooler.
Yeah. Well, it does,
yes, and so we have the opportunity to gather experts from around the country, and not just preservation people, and not just design people, but people who deal with finance, people to actually make deals work in preservation. That's what's missing in this equation. We all have ideas we think would work. But even if there is a public use envisioned for Old City Hall, there may be a way for a public-private partnership that has not been explored. So what we hope to do after this 8-hour event on next Tuesday is to leave behind for the city to consider not just a range of uses, but potential ways to pay for it.
To figure out how to fund it.
Yeah.
We are talking about historic preservation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I just would like for the panel to speak about the necessity to have someone who is committed to the development or the successful outcome of any historic district.
Thanks very much for the question, Tracy.
Just to give you a little background.
Sure.
There's two African-American historic districts in Indianapolis, and most people don't know that. And also, the city is not providing the necessary infrastructure support to make these districts successful. So I just would like for the panel to just speak about that.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call and the question. Suzanne, I could see you counting the number. Actually, there are more than two.
That's right. Yeah, actually, I was counting them up in my head. And again, a lot of people don't realize. We talked about the Flanner House Homes, which is one the neighborhood just north of Attucks. There's the 500 block of Indiana Avenue, which was a significant location of a lot of African American owned businesses. There's the Ransom Place neighborhood, which is just it's very close to the Walker Theater, which is also, that's actually a National Historic Landmark. Did I get them all?
That's three.
That's three, and then one just went.
Well, I'll tell you, the other part of Tracy's question was investing in the infrastructure, what the city does. I mean, does the city have a role in investing in the infrastructure of these historic places, Paul, would you say?
That's going to be that's a question that's really above my pay grade. I don't make any of the decisions about how the infrastructure dollars are spent. I can tell you there's a lot more desire out there for work than there are resources to pay for it. And that's just a general statement throughout the entire city. I think the mayor has done a tremendous job trying to take the resources that he has and spread them around as best that he can. You know, I don't know that that it's appropriate to single out the historic neighborhoods to the for the folks that don't get it, they're going to say, why'd you pick out that particular neighborhood? You know, because it's historic. What about us? You know, it's hard to it'd be hard to make that kind of decision. And again, I can't speak for how those dollars are spent, but I can tell you it's not for want of trying that the neighborhoods aren't invested in.
Is there let's broaden that a little bit because basically it's a reinvestment question. Do we spend enough, you know, as a community, as a state, even as a nation, on historic preservation? Marsh, I'll start with you.
Oh, man. If we're talking about public dollars, mm-hmm. First, I think that there's a tremendous commitment in the private sector toward preservation. And the more incentives we can create for that investment, all the better. We're working on that, you know, all the time at Indiana Landmarks to improve incentives at the state level. Let's look for a moment at public dollars for preservation. There ain't a lot out there. You know, there's no big pot of money at the federal level. Certainly, there was a wonderful program a few years ago that had a whopping $25 million, and it was cut in half. And those are funds through the Save America's Treasures program that went to the very best of our nation's heritage. And we're talking about less than $500,000 per state for the very best of our heritage. And it's gone entirely now. It's gone. What we do have is still as a major incentive, though, for private investment are tax credits at the federal level. And these are being viewed as something that might go away to help in the budgetary debates. We have tax credits at the state level for investment in income-producing properties that are historic. And these credits are basically dysfunctional. We've been trying for 6 years working with the state legislature. We're getting close, but we've not been able to unravel this unworkable tax credit program we have, which has such an incredibly low annual allocation cap that's basically unusable. So I think certainly the will is there in the private sector. The dollars in the public sector are scarce, but we in the preservation community are constantly on guard to protect what little we have, and it seems to be shrinking.
Is the great challenge here, you know, not just the initial cost in preserving or renovating something, but coming up with a sustainable model after you've done so? Suzanne?
Well, I was going to comment that, you know, Tracy raises a good point about investing in neighborhoods, and so much of this really has to be done at the grassroots level, and that also gets into that sustainability, is that if the neighborhood is able to pull together and do some research and find out the significance of that area and help promote it to other people, they can get more attention, have people come in and use private dollars and restore it. And so that does kind of help with that sustainability. I think Ransom Place Historic District was very early on in promoting its African-American heritage by putting up signs in the yards, educating people about the history of the buildings, and putting together walking tours. So there's a lot of grassroots work that can go a long way.
We've gotten a listener question. Didn't want to go on the air, asked if there are any programs designed to get young people involved in historic preservation work and get them excited about it. Marsh, Suzanne, I'm imagining that's right in your wheelhouse. We'll go to Suzanne.
I just finished one, and it was one of the most rewarding experiences. Because the conference is in Indianapolis, we received a grant from the National Park Service to host a youth summit. So we took 45 students and 8 teachers from around the state down to southern Indiana, and we looked at African-American resources, or specifically Underground Railroad. And it wasn't just a field trip. What we had the kids do was evaluate existing museums and tourism programs and to provide feedback on how we could better engage youth in the preservation and the study of things like the Underground Railroad. And it was such a great success, and we had so much wonderful feedback that we're really excited about trying to raise the money to make this an annual event and spread it around the state. But we've also for years been doing Archie camps, which are children's day camps, and we do those again around the state where we have kids ages 7 through 12 get together and do activities related to local history and architecture.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Jan who says, are there any plans to preserve the oldest columned facade of Wishart Hospital after the new hospital opens? Marsh?
I don't know the specific plans, but we're certainly willing to engage in that discussion. I can't say for certain if there are any solid plans.
Presuming Jan's got an interest, if she wanted to engage in that discussion with you, how should she reach you?
She can call me at 800-450-4534. If it's local, 639-4534.
Could you give those numbers again real quickly?
Out of the city, it's 800-450-4534. Or here in town, 639-4534. That's the office number at Indiana Landmarks. And you can ask for me, Marsh Davis, and I'd be happy to talk about it.
In terms of the idea of preserving our links to the past and all of that, I think it was the National Underground Railroad story that Suzanne was telling just a second ago. you know, in Franklin, it was a spot on the Underground Railroad. There's a plaque. It's right in front of a 1970s-style apartment building now, and I think because of that, a lot of people walk right past the plaque, don't understand the significance of the spot. You know, is some of the motivation to holding on to these places is so that it doesn't become something that's easy to walk past and forget about. Suzanne?
Most definitely. I think any time you have a place that you can tie to an event or a part of our history, you make a much stronger connection than you do when you've got a marker. And as Paul mentioned early on, once these places are gone, they're gone. And a lot of times, some of the landmarks that may be associated with a history that we're not looking to promote so much, like the Underground Railroad, kind of get dismissed and people want to forget about them. But they really do tell a powerful story, and so that's definitely one of the reasons why we want to preserve the physical spaces.
We're getting close on time. With all of these people coming from around the country, what is I'll give you a couple of options of the way you want to answer this question. What is the one site here in Indianapolis or in Indiana that you hope they see the most or that you think they will be the most blown away by? One or the other. Paul, I'll start with you.
Well, we certainly hope that the Old North Side neighborhood, which is, like I said, 35 years in the making in terms of its rebirth, we certainly hope, especially featuring 8 of the homes, plus having Indiana Landmark Center and the Morris Butler Museum, that we hope that people, one of their takeaways would be how wonderful this neighborhood looks and how wonderful it functions, and the fact that 35 years ago people came down for a reason that's far different than today. Back then they came down to restore an old house. Today they come down for a wonderful quality of life, and I think that's to be celebrated.
Okay. Suzanne?
I'm going to cop out and not pick my favorite, but tell everybody to take time to just be a tourist in your own town. We always kind of forget, you know, the important buildings in our own community. So look around and see what you've got.
What do you think? I'm not going to let you off the hook quite that easily. I get paid to ask questions. So what do you think the visitors are going to be most surprised by then, with what they see here?
I think sort of the general design of Indianapolis with Monument Circle and then heading north with the City Beautiful planning concept around the War Memorial Plaza and just what a walkable city it is and how much we've preserved.
Marsh, we've got about 30 seconds. What do you hope to show them?
Well, I try to think of that when I'm walking around downtown. I think, what are people going to see? And I start looking at the city differently, too, and I start finding these great highlights. Obviously, people have not been here before. Monument Circle is going to blow them away because it's just one of the great urban spaces in the world. It's terrific.
That's going to be the last word. I think it's a good last word. I would like to thank my guests, Marsh Davis and Suzanne Stanis of Indiana Landmarks, Paul Smith, who's the real estate manager for the city of Indianapolis, for joining us for this lively discussion about historic preservation in honor of the fact that Indianapolis will host the National Historic Preservation Conference next week. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.